I brought along my son Jonathan, who in the year 2001 will be the same age as I am now. Maybe he will be better adjusted to this kind of world that you're trying to portray.
The big difference when he grows up, in fact, if we wanted to wait for the year 2001, is that he will have in his own house, not a computer as big as this, but at least a console through which he can talk to his friendly local computer and get all the information he needs for his everyday life, like his bank statements, his theater reservations, all the information you need in the course of living in a complex modern society. This will be in a compact form in his own house. He'll have a television screen like these here and a keyboard, and he'll talk to the computer, get information from it, and he'll take it as much for granted as we take the telephone.
I'm Cortana.
Welcome. Welcome to the Sydney Dev event. Thanks so much for all of you to come here, and also thank you to the live stream for tuning in. So what we just saw was 43 years of computing in under a minute. And what's amazing is we saw this guy, Arthur C. Clarke, talk about technology, and he got it right almost to the day. And he talked about the internet before it existed. He talked about apps. He talked about social. But most of all, he talked about intelligence and how machines would speak to us and hear us and be able to understand us. And he talked about how transformative that would be. But really, when I think about the transformative power of computing, this is what I think about. I'm a developer. I've been developing my whole life. And you see that look in my eye? That's true love. My wife says, I don't look at her like I look at that computer screen. She might be right. And what's really amazing about this is at a really early age, I didn't know I worked at Microsoft, but I knew computing could change my life. And what's interesting, more interesting than that, is 3 years later, this was me. It's my first science fair project. You'll see it says, computers or humans, who should rule? And I took that question really seriously. My mom asked, she says, why don't you smile? And I said, this is a very serious question, Mom. And what I actually did was I used Lisp, and I built or attempted to build an AI that understood law. Because I figured out, even back in the 70s, that computers were going to be everywhere, and we could use them to help people. And what you're here today to do, just like the guys from Hack for Good, is get your skills up and understand where computing and DevOps is going. And so with that, we've got a really rich day packed for you. Before we get into it, I want to first acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and their elders past and present, and those who may be here with us today. And to also recognize the fact that in Aboriginal culture, they met on land to exchange knowledge. And that's what we're going to do today, talking about cognitive services, cognitive intelligences in Azure. And so with that, I couldn't think of a more special way to kick this off than to welcome here in Sydney, and I'm so excited to have him here, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella. Please.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's fantastic to be here in Australia and in Sydney this morning to kick off a developer event. For me, as I think about Microsoft, the source of inspiration has always been talking to developers. And in fact, it starts with that sense of purpose and mission that drives everything that we do, every product we build, every action we take, the choices we make in how we show up with customers, all comes from the sense of purpose and mission, which is to empower every person and every organization on the planet to achieve more. And there are many key aspects to this. For example, when I think about who we are as a company, we think deeply about both people and institutions that people build to outlast them. Both of them are first class, even in our software constructs. We, of course, think about this at global scale. I am a product of the democratizing technology of Microsoft reaching me where I was growing up. My entire story is a reflection of this company doing what it does to bring technology to all corners of the globe. But perhaps most importantly, it's that last piece. Digital technology is great. Our products, we want to push the envelope, but it's really about what others do with that technology. How do they go on to build on top of our platforms? How do they go on to achieve their dreams? That's, to us, the core to our mission. And when you talk about achieving more and creating platforms for others to create their own platforms and technology, no better place to start than developers. In fact, our very origin, I'm always reminded of, whenever I think about this mission statement, I always go back to the very creation of Microsoft. When Bill dropped out of college, it was to create that basic interpreter for the Altair. A lot has changed since then, but that sense of creating tools for developers remains at the heart of who we are as a company. And today's day and age, where digital technology is pervasive, in fact, in the last day and a half or so that I've spent in Australia, it's been fantastic to see how you all as developers in Australia are contributing to the broad spectrum across every industry, every vertical, every walk of life. Everyone is becoming more and more digital. In some sense, every company now, whether you're a retailer or in healthcare or in insurance or in mining, you do want to think of yourself also being in a digital business. That's the opportunity for everyone in this audience. Every developer has both that opportunity and also responsibility to be able to create digital technology that creates surplus in our societies and in our economies. And to me, our goal as a company is to provide the tools, the platforms, so that developers can then have that profound impact across industries, across all walks of life. The worldview we have in terms of technology is what I describe as this mobile-first, cloud-first world. We have a pretty distinctive point of view when we say mobile-first. It's not about the mobility of any single device. It's the mobility of the human experience across all the computing in our lives. Because if one thing's going to be true, it is that we are going to have more computing, not less computing, as each year goes on. We're going to have general-purpose sensors in every room that we walk into that are possible that can run general-purpose compute. We're going to have small screens, large screens. And so the goal is to be able to have the mobility of the human experience across all of that computing. And that's what the cloud enables. The cloud is the control plane that gives you that mobility across all of your computings. That's why I think of both of these revolutions happening together. We want to build three distinct platforms that in fact come together. We describe them as our three ambitions, so that they create a huge canvas of opportunity for every developer here. And I want to use my time this morning to just kind of walk through what that opportunity looks like. What's that innovation curve that you can tap into across each one of these platforms? And I want to start with this reinvention of productivity and business process. An area where Microsoft has great momentum is with our Office 365 and Dynamics 365 products. It's not just a migration to the cloud. Of course, it is a part of the story where some of the server infrastructure is now moving to a cloud deployment. But it's much more profound than that, especially when viewed through the lens of developers. For example, all of the data underneath Office 365 across OneDrive, Exchange, Skype, take any one of the products, Yammer, are all being exposed as a graph structure, what we reference as the Microsoft graph, that is available to every developer. So that means you will be able to query, reason over this data so that you can add additional value. In fact, you can contribute to this graph and you can consume the graph. To us, being able to unlock that data layer underneath Office is going to be pretty profound in how developers can help organizations that use these tools get more out of their time and energy. One of the other things that we're also doing is not just opening up the data layer, but also the scaffolding on the user experience through a very modern add-in architecture so that you can have your applications be more discoverable within the scaffolding of Office and all of the use cases of Office. So that's Office 365 more as a platform. And that's essentially what we're doing even with Dynamics 365. In the case of Dynamics, there is a rich data model, which is in relational databases today. But instead of having them locked up in expensive suites of CRM or ERP, we're completely busting that open. We are going from having these suites of software to effectively having a modular, componentized, role-oriented suite of business applications that you can tap into for your specific needs. Because as the world becomes more digitized, you need more automation and more business process automation. And we believe that by bringing together Dynamics 365 as this modular business process layer that can be extended by developers for a variety of different industries is going to completely change how we think about business process automation. In fact, the impedance that existed between productivity and communications and business process is what we want to completely get rid of so that users can use their software that much more productively. That's what we mean by reinvention of productivity. Now, beyond all of the professional developer capability, we also want to make it possible, just like back in the day Visual Basic did, or Access did, for a power user to be able to also build applications. Because as you see organizations adopt Office 365 and Dynamics 365, it becomes very important to customize it, tailor it for your very specific business process needs. And so for this software as a service age, it's very exciting to see the emergence of a new application platform for professional users or pro users beyond pro developers. And that is Power Apps and Flow and Power BI. The combination of having a visual designer, the ability to do workflow, as well as having business intelligence. Because there is not going to be a single application that you're going to build going forward that doesn't come with analytics built in. And that combination of Power Apps Flow and Power BI is a rich toolkit and a rich tool set and a new app plat for every professional user and every pro user to be able to be a developer. And we are seeing this. I had a chance to sort of really look at many, many examples of organizations in Australia that are deploying these applications. But more importantly to me, they're not just deploying these applications, they're tailoring them so that they can achieve their business outcomes. One of the companies, Bupa, is an insurance company that is now taken Dynamics 365, Office 365, and in fact a lot of Azure, and customized it in ways so that they can respond to their customers in much more personalized way. So that's in insurance, and the same thing is happening in banking with Beyond Bank, where they've again deployed the same set of tools and really approached the empowering of every employee within the organization who is responsible for customers to have that 360-degree view, and not just the 360-degree view of the customer, to be able to automate the task the customers expects them to do. So this level of customization and agility is what this new tool set enables. The next platform area for us is the cloud infrastructure. And the approach we're taking here again with the cloud infrastructure is to build out a global, trusted, hybrid infrastructure. Today, Azure runs across 30 different regions in the world, including Australia. And the idea here is to make sure that we have a hyperscale cloud that operates all over the world. So if you are a developer here, not only do you have data centers in the region so that you can build your applications and make it serve customers here, but as a startup, as a large company, large ISV, you can in fact scale beyond Australia to any one of the countries that we operate in and any one of the regions we operate in. Trust is the new currency when it comes to digital technology. So that means when you're operating something like a hyperscale cloud, you want to respect the digital sovereignty needs of countries. You want to respect the regulatory needs of industries. You want to be able to make sure that the operational security that you have in your infrastructure operations are best in class so that you can build trust in the computing platform. That's at the core of how we are building out Azure. And then the last piece is we think of distributed computing as distributed computing. In other words, even though we do have a hyperscale cloud infrastructure, we make available that same infrastructure at the edge of our cloud, especially with things like IoT, where there is going to be a lot of data generated in the edge, there is going to be a need for compute in the edge. So when we think about our servers, we think of them as the edge of our cloud. So when we build SQL 2016, it has the ability to stretch its database into our cloud. Your queries will work seamlessly. When we think about Windows Server 2016, we think again about being able to orchestrate, whether it's containers or virtual machines, across a hybrid backplane. That's the architecture that we have in terms of hybrid. Now, all that gives immense amount of power to every developer. That means you have compute storage network that comes together in this hybrid compute paradigm, giving you ultimate flexibility of your infrastructure. You can run Windows, you can run Linux. You can run Docker containers, you can run .NET, you can run Java. The idea that you can really have the most flexible infrastructure, bring any framework and tool, and build any application, mobile applications, web applications, bots, or IoT or SaaS applications. That's the idea. The idea is to be able to democratize the cloud computing power for every developer out there. Now, having that infrastructure ultimately is to help developers use that infrastructure to do new and innovative things. And I was excited to meet with the team at Webjet that's been in the travel business on a variety of parts of the value chain. And they've used Azure over the years for a variety of different transactional and business process needs. But recently, they had an idea of saying, how do we use blockchain, which we now have on Azure as a service, to completely change how settlement happens on the wholesale side of travel? But you can imagine how blockchain and its distributed ledger capabilities can be transformative in changing the curve of settlement and transaction costs. And so it is fantastic to see a group of developers here come together and do a pilot using very new cutting-edge technology like blockchain available in Azure, but most importantly, for them to transform an entire industry going forward. So that's an example of what developers are doing using the capabilities of Azure. And when you think about any infrastructure in any generation, you always want to think about what's going to define the applications that you build. What's going to characterize those applications? When you look back 5 years from now at the applications built today, what's going to be that defining characteristic? And it's going to be data. Or more importantly, it's going to be about reasoning over data, large amounts of it, and to be able to create intelligence. And that's what we are building Cortana Intelligence Suite for. We want to put into your hands as developers the richest toolkit to be able to store large amounts of data of any type, to be able to process that data, and to be able to create intelligence out of it. That's what the Cortana Intelligence Suite does. And it's fantastic to see again in Cortana Intelligence Suite the one specific area and its use cases, which you're going to hear a lot more about even as part of this conference, which is cognitive APIs. We've taken some of the state-of-the-art technology, whether it be speech, computer vision, natural language understanding, or even the knowledge that we gain, and making it available as APIs to developers. Our goal truly is to build, take all of these as building blocks and make it part of applications that you go on to build. Take speech. We today have the world record or the state of the art around speech recognition, which is measured by the word error rate, which is at around 6.3%. Same thing with computer vision and object recognition at around 3.5%. And for you as developers, that's just an API call away so that you can incorporate it in your applications. In fact, in the intro video, you saw some of those computer vision algorithms being used by Shakib as he builds out his Seeing AI project. And so to us, bringing that state-of-the-art controls and APIs is reminiscent of what we did in the client-server era with visual controls. What we did there with visual controls is what we want to do with cognitive APIs for this generation of developers. And to just give you a flavor for how these are being used, I wanted to roll the video of all the developers using Cortana Intelligence. Let's roll the video.
Thank you.
And as you see in that video, it's interesting to note that things like machine learning and artificial intelligence are not just for consumer internet companies. They're broadly being deployed in the context of healthcare companies, retail companies, industrial companies. And even yesterday I had a chance to go walk to MCG and onto the field, which has been one of my dreams all my life. And I know it's not probably the best day to talk about cricket in Australia, but I was glad to see how Cricket Australia plans on using machine learning to bring, I mean, cricket is perhaps one of the richest sports when it comes to data, but how could you harness the power of data to even start having a more intelligent, informed conversation about performance of teams, performance of players? And to me, Cricket Australia is beginning that journey using some of the same technology, same things that you saw that are being used by industrial companies or healthcare companies or robotics companies. And so the idea that developers can have or bend the curve even in cricket performance is perhaps one of the most empowering things I've seen in my life. The thing that I want to sort of talk a little bit about is where do we go in AI as we take the next 4 or 5 years and what developers are going to do with AI. We are building not just Azure to have rich compute capability, but we are in fact building the world's first AI supercomputer. By building in the support for these field programmable gate arrays, you truly are making it possible for developers to create intelligence and get beyond even any limitations of Moore's law. That means the algorithms, take your deep neural nets that you are using to do computer vision or speech recognition or natural language processing. You can run them at silicon speed by really tapping into the fabric of field programmable gate arrays. And so this exascale computer is what we are building in Azure. Pretty much every compute node of Azure has FPGA support, and that's what's going to be available to every developer out there. I mean, that to me is perhaps one of the things that we're going to look back 5 years, 10 years from now, when we look at the applications that were built, and we're going to say, wow, how was that feature even possible? How was it trained using that kind of scale? And it's just the idea that now it's available to every developer out there. It's no longer just a few supercomputers, but a supercomputer that is available to every developer. Now, today, in fact, we announced a further set of advances around this AI capability of Azure. With the N-series virtual machines in Azure and the best-in-class GPU support, beyond FPGA and CPUs, we even have the best GPU support. And it turns out GPUs are fantastic, especially around deep neural nets. And to have that support in Azure means every developer, again, can tap into it as you train your algorithms, as you build out your algorithms. And OpenAI, which is created by Elon Musk and Sam Altman, has decided to use Azure for their projects around OpenAI, where they've assembled a fantastic world-class team, and they are going to be tapping into the Azure capabilities around AI for them to, in fact, further their research agenda. We also are launching today the Azure Bot Service. You're going to have, again, more sessions on this. To me, this is a fantastic example of how to take conversational understanding and bring that to bear, and language understanding to bring that to bear, to build these new classes of applications. Just like you built websites in the past or mobile applications in the past, you're going to now start building bots as new interfaces, new applications. You're going to take every business process and build a bot interface. But in order to do that, you need to have natural language understanding. And that's what the bot framework enables for every developer. And Azure Functions is a new way for you to think about a world where microservices are built using serverless infrastructure. And when you put these things all together, serverless infrastructure with Azure Functions, language understanding and bot frameworks, AI capabilities, whether they're coming from FPGAs or GPUs, what you're seeing are the beginnings of a complete new compute fabric that can allow you as developers to build applications with immense power to change every industry and every walk of life. That's what is really in front of us. Now, I want to talk about the last platform opportunity, which is as profound as what's happening in the productivity and business process as well as cloud infrastructure space, which is in the more personal computing arena. We are building Windows 10 not as just an operating system for a device. We're building it out as an operating system for the user across all of their computing devices. When we conceptualized Windows 10 as a service, the idea was to make sure that you have an operating system that, of course, goes kernel up on a device, but it is also Windows Update to the user experience across all of the devices. We're also innovating on the new input-output, the new computing media, pen, speech, ink, and even augmented reality. We want to not only bring together new types of input-output, we also want to balance that input-output ratio. I believe in the last 10 years, when we've thought about computers and computing, there's been more consumption. In the next 10 years, we think that there's going to be more of a balance between creation and consumption, and that requires us to push the envelope of inventing new form factors. That's what led us to build the 2-in-1 with Surface. That's what led us to build Surface Hub, the big screen collaborative computer. And that's what led us recently to build Surface Studio. Let's roll the video.
Spin.
building out these new computers and a new way to do computing is only meaningful if it can have broad impact inside of our organizations. And I've had a chance to meet with many customers and many organizations in Australia that are deploying Windows 10 at very rapid rates. But the one particular one that I picked today to talk about is the Australian Department of Human Services, because I know it touches the lives of every Australian. They've deployed Windows 10, but one of the things that they're pushing is not just the deployment of Windows 10, but how they're able to harness the power of data and technology, push the envelope, especially around assistive technologies, with their own push towards universal design, to make sure that every member of this department is then able to serve every citizen of this country with that much more efficiency, with that much more knowledge. To us, ultimately, that's what new computers and new computing is all about. Great design, great work, new input, new output should fundamentally help bring more people access to information so that they can achieve their full potential. And I think that there's no better example than what the Australian Department of Human Services is doing with technology, not only inside their organization, but more importantly, for the citizens of this country. Talking about new computers and computing, one of the most exciting things that's happening right in front of our eyes is the creation of a new medium that we described as mixed reality, where you can take 3D objects, you can scan essentially anything in the physical world, convert it into a 3D object, a digital object, enhance it, give it a physics engine, in other words, give it motion. You can then put that digital artifact with motion back into the physical world and have it world lock. That means it can, in fact, recognize the real world. That spectrum of starting from the real world and enhancing the real world is what we describe as mixed reality. And what we're doing with Microsoft Paint or PowerPoint on one end to what we're doing with HoloLens on the other end are all at the point of creation of this new medium. And it's amazing to see the developers and what they're doing with it. In fact, in Australia, Saab Defence, which is a subsidiary of Saab, in Australia has gone and taken HoloLens and built out an application so that special forces or anyone in the rescue operations can visualize and create the operational plans in very hazardous situations. Because when you take what is your computer vision or your own field of view and convert it into an infinite display, you completely change what computing looks like. It's the ultimate computer. And to give you a feel for how this ultimate computing medium and computing will change every walk of life, let's roll the video of what developers are doing with mixed reality. Thank you. that tagline that you sort of saw in the video of when you change the way you see the world, you change the world you see, really speaks to the, I think, the opportunity in front of us. And what developers are able to do with these new computers, these new platforms, to have real impact is what, to us, gives us true meaning to the work that we do. I know as part of this conference, we even had Hack for Good sessions, and I just had a chance to meet developers who were, you know, participated in it and were the winners of those hackathons. And it is fantastic to see these new ideas that are being translated into products that could really have huge impact. And talking about that, I also had a chance to meet with one of the Imagine Cup winners a few years back, Inemia. In fact, they described themselves as doctors by day and developers by night. And they had this idea that if they can detect anemia in people, you can then have that really have profound impact on the medical outcomes for those people by just taking a selfie, just being able to recognize in a selfie whether you have anemia or not, and then to be able to intervene with iron supplements and then change the entire trajectory of that person's life is a profound thing that any developer can imagine and then go about realizing that. So they're now in clinical trials, or they're doing trials in Africa and other parts of other emerging markets. And this is a couple of students who had an idea, won the Imagine Cup, and now are going on to use technology that's available to them in the cloud, in mobile devices, and to truly transform lives. To me, that's the kind of stories that inspire us. That's really the opportunity in front of everyone who is a developer, and in particular developers, because in a day and age where digital technology is so pervasive, the opportunity is enormous. The question really is, how do we step up to take the responsibility given that opportunity to have broad impact? And that's where I have all the confidence that what you learn today is going to translate into you not just imagining a bright future, but creating it. Thank you all so very, very much. Thank you.
Satya Nadella. So inspiring to have a leader like Satya plan out this vision and watch Microsoft execute it. It's just been awe-inspiring, and we're happy to have him here today. He mentioned a lot. He talked about developers. He talked about the infrastructure of the future, the infrastructure now. But he also mentioned blockchain and what the organization Webjet was doing with it. So we thought, what better way to dive into it than to bring out the Webjet team and Microsoft's own senior innovator, Felicity Turner.
Thank you, Lawrence. Wow, look at this place. I'm so excited to be here, but particularly excited to be here with the team from Webjet. We've got Graham,
Link,
Shashank, and Mittal. Now, I have been lucky enough to work with these guys for the last 6 months, including the extended team at Microsoft on a blockchain project. Now, most people would actually think of blockchain and associate it with financial services industry, but Webjet is Australia's leading online travel agency. So, Graham, how did the two things come together?
That's a great question, Felicity. Hopefully over the next few minutes we'll give you a bit of an overview and context, and then the guys will go into some detail and talk about the solution. Look, Webjet, as you said, we're probably best known as Australia's online travel, leading online travel agency, but we also run a B2B hotel distribution business. We operate in the global hotel supply chain. We started around 4 years ago with a startup in Dubai, and that's grown to operate out the Middle East and Africa, and more recently in North America. That's a company called Lots of Hotels. Then we acquired another business in Spain, in Palma, Mallorca. That's a company called Sun Hotels, and that looks after a lot of Europe. And more recently, last week, we launched a new business established in Asia, That's a company called Fitrooms. So we're starting to piece together our global B2B picture. And as we do that, I mentioned we operate in the hotel supply chain. So we're scaling up. And as we scale up, we want to make sure we keep the costs low and we operate on a low-cost model. And that's where we started looking at blockchain and what that can do for us.
Great. Would you want to take everyone through some of the complexities of that supply chain model that you deal with?
Sure. So there are many participants in the hotel supply chain, buying and selling the hotel inventory and making sure it gets to the customer. We operate, as I said, as a couple of those entities, so lots of hotels and Sun Hotels. So at the point of booking, you make a booking on a website or on a travel agent. That booking flows through that supply chain, and each participant in that supply chain has their own system. And they talk to each other at the point of booking, so there's a record of that booking in the proprietary systems. And they're stored in their own sort of data sets, and there's no commonality really across those data sets other than booking a room and its availability. So when the hotel wants to invoice back up that chain, they push the invoice up to each of those participants, and that's where there could be a lot of data discrepancies. And that could be over a period of, say, 6 months because it's invoiced at the point of checkout. So it's a big cost in the industry to start reconciling on data points that may or may not be there. So there is a lot of breakage there.
And how can blockchain actually resolve that?
So for us, we looked at blockchain because we could write a smart contract. So we could have a booking record on that contract. It's completely distributed. It's owned by nobody. It's visible by everybody. It's irrefutable, auditable, all those great words that you associate with blockchain. So I'm going to hand over to Shashank and Mittal, and they'll run through a bit more on the detail and the solution that we've built without giving too much of the secret sauce away.
Thank you, Graham. So for our project, we decided to go with Ethereum as a blockchain technology, primarily because it was the most widely distributed and supported blockchain currently. We partnered with Microsoft back in July over a hackathon, the goal of which was to create a POC around this concept. This helped us validate our thinking and further our understanding with the blockchain technology and understanding of smart contracts. While this was successful, what we created wasn't a true consortium and was not production ready.
So to extend our POC and building a true consortium, we leverage a Batchly template, which is Microsoft Azure Blockchain as a Service. And we created 3 nodes in Europe, Asia, and Australia. And we started pushing data and transactions to those nodes. So if you zoom into one of the members, you can see it runs load balancer, private virtual network, and the virtual VM running. We call it miner and transaction node. Those are the Linux virtual machine running in the Azure. Transaction node has a copy of the blockchain, but they basically don't mine transaction, and they actually send to the miners. Miners runs transactions, runs some algorithm on it, and adds to the chain. And chain grows, and it's read-only data. Nobody can tamper with it. We also build up some of the reporting and dashboard around it to visualize the chain. We'll dig into it a bit later.
So let's have a look at the demo. So over here we have EtherStats producing this dashboard, which is an open source tool, allows you to monitor a Ethereum blockchain. So as Mittal pointed out, we have 3 consortiums. You have Sun, LOH, and an escrow party we created. You can also distinguish the transaction nodes and the mining nodes. The transaction nodes don't run GET. They only accept transactions which come into the pending queue and distribute it to the miners. The miners mine the transactions and create new blocks and achieve consensus across the network. Switch back to the presentation. To achieve real business value, though, while the monitoring is good to visualize the health of the chain, to achieve real business value, you need to have a robust reporting and reporting framework. So we decided to leverage Ethereum events and created a notification, a reporting contract. So the reporting contract monitors these events on the chain and pushes that data into event hubs. Once it's an event hub, it allows us to customize the reporting and notifications based on the members' needs. So you could have it being powered by Power BI, persistent storage for data mining, or even custom notifications in apps. So we'll just demo a Power BI dashboard we created. So this is sample data, so the figures aren't really accurate, but it gives you an idea of what a member can see. At a glance, they can visualize the smart contracts that are at play and also focus on any disputes or inconsistencies they might have and drill down and solve those before it becomes a real financial impact to the organization.
So thanks for that, Shashank. Mittal, have you got any sort of advice or learnings that you can share with the group? Because this is new technology for us.
Oh, yes. So as you know, blockchain is an immutable data store. So when you write a smart contract, you need to make sure there is a right, you know, code being written around security, and you need to make sure there's also version compatible between the contract, and also need to be sure they are backward compatible with the previous contract as well when it runs through. Ethereum is a rapidly growing technology. A lot of organizations are transforming their business based on the blockchain, and there are a lot of tools and technology available in the market to choose and, you know, best suits your needs.
Yep. So during our journey, we got to play with a lot of different tools and frameworks, some of which solved our problems and some of which created some new ones. So the key takeaway is be prepared to experiment and then move on.
Okay, thanks for that.
So just to close out, Graham, I'd love to understand, what are the next steps for Webjet then with blockchain?
We've been really excited with the results so far across the business, and we're running two of our businesses in the consortium. Talked about FitRooms earlier. We're going to put that new company into the consortium. We're going to run it for a couple more months, experiment, learn, that sort of stuff, and then we will start opening it up to external parties. Excellent. So we're looking forward to where this is going to go.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Graham, Shashank and Mittal, for working together for the last 6 months and for the presentation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Felicity, Shashank, Mittal, Graham, thanks for that. So we've just had a 50,000-foot tour, an overview of how powerful you can use Azure to build out these amazing solutions to scale. But what's it like to actually build one? Well, this is a developer event, so we're going to be writing some code and deploying them. So let me please welcome to the stage my good friend and colleague, technical evangelist, senior technical evangelist, Jordan Knight.
Yes! We didn't miss the high five. I might surprise you guys to learn that until this morning, I was not very good at high fives. And I actually talked to Lawrence, and I said, maybe we should pull it out, because, you know, if you miss a high five at the start, there's no coming back from that. And he goes, Jordan, I'm going to give you a bit of advice. Aim for the elbow. And so now I know that's how to do an absolutely fantastic high five, and you can see it in action. And if you see me around after this, maybe we should have a bit of a practice. So welcome all, everyone, today. And as Lawrence said, this is our developer portion of the event. We've got an absolutely jam-packed session for you guys today. We've got code demos, we've got DevOps, and just about everything in between. As Lawrence mentioned, I'm a developer evangelist. And what that means is I work with software developers and software development teams to help them build amazing things on top of Microsoft technologies. I'm actually a software developer myself. I used to run a software development company before I started at Microsoft. And back there, we were building apps for Xbox One and Xbox 360 and a whole range of other platforms, iOS, Android, some cloud scalable platforms. What I've learned over the years is that my core passion lies in building software for other developers, whether that be tools or frameworks or self-documenting systems, anything that helps a code base be better, anything that helps people work on that code base, especially for younger or more inexperienced developers, that's what really gets me excited. And so today, we're going to concentrate a lot on that experience and that extra little bit above and beyond just showing code and how to do things. I was actually thinking back to the last time that we were on this stage here at the Star Casino. It was back in 2009. I actually didn't work for Microsoft back then, but I was still presenting a session. It was on Silverlight 3 at the time. We're talking about Expression Blend. We're talking about really fantastic modern user interfaces and really slick IDEs. So like Expression Blend, you might remember that product. And the core focus was on client app dev. Even just 7 years ago, we didn't have Azure yet. That came out in February 2010. We didn't have Xamarin or NuGet. We didn't really have DevOps. I think at the time, I remember, we would pretty much just build it, and if it works on our machine, we'd ship it. Maybe that's not quite fair. We did have some CI. We did have a little bit of automated testing and things like that. But DevOps as a practice, DevOps is something that you can go away and actually learn and become good at and get a job in, didn't really come about until just after that. And so back in 2009, we were focusing on these really slick UIs, and the user experience that for developers was quite, I guess, obvious. You could see it. It was in the actual products. Flash forward to now, in this cloud-first, mobile-first world, and UI or user experience for developers might not be so obvious, especially in cloud app development. What isn't clear, because the UIs might be hidden under the covers, is that you have to go and dig a little bit deeper to go and find the user experience and find those things that really do work for software developers. Because these days, a user experience for developers is just so much more than an IDE. It's about mature, modern APIs and advanced SDKs to go with them, and self-documenting and advanced documentation systems that developers can just go and use. It's about working where you want as developers on the platform of your choice. It's about the safety nets that modern server systems provide, like automatically scaling and feeding information back from production data into your development process using hard data from the field. So that's what I want to focus on today. I really want you to remember, as we're going through our demonstrations, that we're talking about the user experience for developers. So I guess you could call that developer experience, which happens to be pretty lucky because that's the department in Microsoft that I happen to work in, the developer experience team. So as I mentioned, we're working super hard at Microsoft to make developers the center of everything we build, and Satya talked about that as well. To demonstrate that today, we're going to go through all the stages of building an app on stage. And it's more than just a bunch of code demos, as I said. And so each step of the way, we're going to be very clear about the types of experiences that you can build for your developers and for your teams. Before I get too much further, I want to introduce you guys to The Repo. Throughout the day, you might hear a little bit about The Repo. And what it is a GitHub repo, aka.ms/The Repo, that you guys can go along to. And you can get all the code examples, as well as documentation and write-ups on how to do each bit of the demos that we're putting on today. So we're going to build our app in a number of stages today. And it's going to be a cloud-based app with most of the features that you'd expect from a modern-day application these days. The first step along the way is that your app needs a home. It needs a center of its universe. And that today is the Azure App Service. It needs to be more than just a server that serves up code to the world. It needs to be a safety net for developers. It needs to be part of your tooling process. It should scale for you. It should do intelligently and proactively tell you when things are going wrong with the system before it happens. It should feed information back into your development lifecycle. But most importantly, you should be able to query it for documentation on its capabilities and basically how you use it. And so to introduce us today to the Azure App Service, I would like to invite onto stage Nick Ward.
Thanks very much, Jordan. Good morning, everyone. This morning, I'd like to share three ways that Azure has helped us to be more productive when we've been building out this application. So those three ways consist of, number one, where do we actually run the application? Where is it hosted? Number two, our application involves APIs, so how are we managing those APIs? And thirdly, how can we be more productive when we're integrating different systems together through workflow? So on to the first one, where are we going to host the application and actually have it run? As Jordan mentioned, Azure App Service is the home of our application and where it lives. Azure App Service is a platform as a service offering in Azure that allows us to host server-based code. That can be a website, it can be an API implementation, it could be a microservice, it could be a mobile app backend. It's platform as a service, so I don't need to have to worry about virtual machines and operating systems and patching and gold images and all of those sorts of things. I can focus just on the code and having it execute. There's a whole bunch of features that I can take advantage of in App Service. I don't have the time this morning to do everything justice, but I'm going to show you a couple of highlights that we've used. This is the App Service that we're using to host this news application that we're working on, and I can see some details about that. But if I go down here, I want to deploy some code to this application, but I don't want to deploy it straight to production. App Service has this great feature called deployment slots that allows me to deploy code to effectively a replica or a copy of my production environment, my production slot. And I can have a number of these, up to 5 with standard and up to 20 with premium. So you can see here I've created a staging slot, and I'm going to wire up this staging slot to that GitHub repository where all of our code is being stored. And when this refreshes, you'll see that that's actually connected. Every time that somebody checks in some code to the master branch, App Service is going to pull down that code, deploy it onto App Service for me, and have it up and running. In this case, because I'm deploying it to the staging slot, that code gets automatically deployed to the staging slot. Nothing I need to do more here than just say connect to GitHub, choose the repository and the branch that I want to connect to, and App Service does the rest for me. We support a bunch of other source code control mechanisms beyond GitHub as well, but that's what we're using for this environment. So once that code's deployed to staging and I've tested it out and I'm happy that it's working successfully, I can go ahead and swap my staging and my production slots. The beauty about doing this is it's about a 30-second or so operation with no downtime to my application. All of my users get routed to the new version of the code, if you will, because I'm swapping the two slots together. We can change all of the configuration variables in a two-phase swap if needed. And one of the things I really like about this is if we have the oops or no moment, the code we promoted actually has a bug that escaped us in our testing, then we can always just swap the slots back and we're back to the original production version of the app. So now that we've got our production environment up and running with the latest version of the code, I can hit the browse button here and I can see that this is our website running in the Azure App Service. Not only is there a web front end to this app, but there's also an API, which we've documented via Swagger. So you can see a big long JSON string there that describes this API in Swagger. I'm going to copy that URL. I don't want people necessarily accessing this API directly. I wanted to do it in a more managed way. And in Azure, we have a service to do that called Azure API Management. So if I go into API Management, I'd just like to point out it is now in the new portal for people who have maybe looked at this before, which is nice. That went live a week or two ago. If I click on the publisher portal, this is where I can import and manage all of my APIs. So to import our new API here, I'm just going to click on Import API, specify the URL for that Swagger definition, and say I am importing Swagger. You can see we also support WSDLs for SOAP APIs. They're supported in API management now as well. I'll give my API a suffix, and I'll select a product to expose this API through. The nice thing about products is we can divide up our API in a whole bunch of different ways for different audiences. Maybe we have an internal view of the API and an external view of the API, for example. And that's it. All I need to do with a Swagger documented API is just import the Swagger definition, and this API is now being managed by Azure API Management. See, I've got a couple of operations I can call on the code now. I can also set up all sorts of policies to rate limit access to this code, to secure access to this API in all sorts of different ways. There's a whole host of policies that we can define. I also have a nice developer portal published from Azure API Management. So developers can come in here, they could sign up for my API, they can get subscription keys to access the APIs that they have access to. And we can see if I go into the news API here that I get a nice documentation experience on how to use this API, including some code snippets in a bunch of different languages. And if I hit the try it button, I can actually go through and actually try out this this API that I now have access to as a developer. I can see exactly what the HTTP request should be, and I can see exactly what I get back in the response payload. So really easy to provide a whole bunch of functionality around policies, documentation, key management, et cetera, for your APIs in Azure API Management. And it's really not a lot of work to bring in your APIs and have them be managed. So last, I want to share with you a little bit about integration and workflow. So we have a serverless environment called Logic Apps. It's one of a few serverless environments we have in Azure, another one being Azure Functions, which just went generally available overnight, which is a serverless code execution environment. That's Azure Functions. Azure Logic Apps is a serverless workflow or integration environment where I can integrate systems together. What we're going to do here is build a small workflow to publish our news items from our API onto Twitter. So the first thing I want to do is trigger my workflow, which I can do through a whole bunch of trigger points, both first-party services from Microsoft and third-party services. In this case, I want my workflow triggered whenever there's a new message arrived on a topic in a service bus queue. So it asks me what the name of the topic is that I want to connect to, and I'll select new news item. So when a new news item is published on the service bus, then I want my workflow to execute. The first thing I want to do then is not interact with all of the services that we provide out of the box, but I actually want to interact with my own managed API. So I select API management, I select my news API, and there's my API operations that I have access to. It needs a subscription key for execution, which I can come back to, but I want to iterate through all of the news items that have just been published. So I'm going to select the body of the get news call as the point at which I'm going to iterate over the content. And finally, I'm going to post a tweet. And in the text to be tweeted, I'm going to select the title of the news item. So you can see I can select out of all of the information that's been brought together from previous steps in the workflow. So in a couple of seconds, built a quick workflow to trigger off a service bus queue and then publish all of the news items to Twitter. So hopefully that's given you a little introduction as to how we're using Azure to be more productive in building this app. Jordan, back to you.
Edge browser.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you saw the Azure App Service, and you saw how it's so much more than just a hosting provider. It's an interconnected system of capabilities that link together to form a fantastically flexible system. We saw API management. You're able to go and provision a developer portal based on nothing more than the documentation that your own app produced in Swagger format. Things like registration and throttling and all that sort of extra bit that can be really difficult to do is done for you. We saw the Azure Service Bus. When we create a new news item in our app, it just pops a message onto a service bus. Where that pops out, we don't know. In this case, Nick was using it in Logic Apps. And so as a developer, I just say, off you go, onto the service bus, and then Logic Apps comes along and it allows people that are not developers to go and finish off and add extra bits to the app without having to bug the developers, you guys. So you can get back on with the job. Now, there's a lot of first-party connectors for Logic Apps, and these are very similar to Flow that Satya talked about earlier on. You can also add your own. In fact, adding your own connectors is done using Swagger. And we're going to see more and more of Swagger today, and I really want to call it out now. Swagger is awesome because having a self-documenting API is awesome. We use it all throughout our demo today, and there's examples all throughout the repo for you guys to go ahead and follow. By exposing Swagger on your API, you're opening it up to a world of possibilities for internal developers as well as external developers. And the best of all is adding it to your project is super simple. If you're using .NET, you can just install a package called Swashbuckle, and off it goes. Otherwise, on other platforms, there's similar things. So we've stopped at the center of our apps universe. We've got a place for it to have a home. The next step along our journey is taking our code and delivering it to where your users are, getting it onto those supercomputers that everyone seems to have in their pockets these days. This is actually a picture of my desk. I've built a few apps over the years, and you can see here just some of the devices that I've been using over the years there that I dug through my cupboard and found. If you've ever built a mobile app, you know that it's really quite difficult, and cross-platform's even harder. But I want to really call out here that developing for cross-platform is so much more than just sharing code. It's about shared DevOps workflows, shared analytics. It's about having one team instead of three teams or two teams. And that's what we really want to get across today. And so to introduce you guys to Xamarin and show you some of the amazing capabilities that it has, I would like to invite out onto stage Kim Philpotts.
Thanks, Jordan. So Nick showed you some amazing stuff with API management that we had. And he also discussed a little bit about, let me just log onto this machine here. He also discussed how we have this Swagger. So Swagger's really cool in that Swagger describes our API. And what I want to talk to you about is how we can wrap that up inside of a mobile application. So we can have a look at our Swagger here, and we can see we have our models, and we can see we can go and execute this and see what it does. But there's actually something else really cool that we can do as well. Let's say we go and we get this. Oops. Let's go and let's go and get this URL up the top here. Let me just reload that for us. Okay, so if I grab this URL and I come over here to Visual Studio. So what I have here is just a simple Xamarin Forms application up here. And what we have is we've got a portable class library here that we can share our code, and we can also share our UI definitions. So the cool thing that I can do here is if I go and right-click on my portable class library, I can come in here and I can say add a REST API client. Then what I can do is I can grab that Swagger URL, I can go and post it into here, and then I can hit the OK button. And what that's going to do is it's going to use that Swagger URL, it's going to call out, it's going to go and create me all of the models and all of the client code that I need to go and access that API. So now I have my models and my client access code. What I can do is while the backend guys are actually generating and writing out that API, I can come in here and I can actually create myself some designer data. So you notice here, I've got this interface called IDX News App Client. So this is the interface that was created by that client tool. And then down below, what I've got here is I've just got some mock data that I'm going to use whilst those guys are building it out. All right, now there's something else really cool that I can do as well. Let's say I'm a developer over on a Mac. Okay, I can come over here and I can use exactly the same solution, exactly the same projects, over here on my Mac in Xamarin Studio. Okay, so let's start building out this application. Now, the first thing I want to do is I want a main view model. Okay, so I've got my view model here, and what you'll see is in the constructor here, it takes in that interface that the client tool created, and then it basically just calls the getNews method. So the getNews method is, again, one that was created by that REST tool. And then we're just basically exposing those news items out as a collection that we can then go and bind to. Next, let's have a look at designing a page here. Okay, now the very first thing you'll notice about this is XAML. Okay, so those of you who have worked with XAML in WPF or UWP applications, you guys already know this stuff. Okay, it's exactly the same. And you can see here I've got my binding context set up here. And inside of here I've got a list view. Inside of that I've got a view cell which basically describes it. So what I'll do is I'll create myself an image in here. And I'll set its source to come from my binding. So I'll make this my image URL in here.
Okay, cool. Now what we can see on the right-hand side of the screen here is I've got a real previewer as well. So I've got a preview, I can see how it's going to look on different form factors and also in different operating systems as I'm writing my XAML here. So let's improve this a little bit. Let's go and set its row span equal to 2, just to make it a little bit bigger. And then we can go and we can style this up as well. Okay, so the styling that we do here is, again, the same as what you'd see inside like a WPF application. Okay, so I think this is called Hero Image. Let's see how that goes. Okay, so it's looking a bit better. I still got to work on that text a little bit. It's not quite displaying how I want. So I'll go ahead and I'll select that. And I'll change this. So this will be my news list box. Cool. So that's looking much nicer now. Now, the next thing I want to do is when the user goes and clicks on one of these items here, I want to navigate to a details page. All right, so you might have noticed up the top here, you know, I've got my binding to my news items. I've also got this item tapped event. So in my item tapped event here, what we can see is we're basically getting the news item that the user tapped on, and then we're navigating to another page. We're navigating to the details page here and passing that news item across. So basically in our details page, what we're doing is we're getting that item, we're setting it as our binding context. So again, let's go and design that page there a little bit. And probably what I want to have here is a scroll view, because it could be that my news article is going to be bigger than one page. And I want to lay my content out down the page. So I'll put this within a stack layout. Okay, then it's just a case of I want to create an image for my header. And again, I'll set that source, and I can use my binding. So I'll say bind this to my image URL. Okay, so we got that there. Maybe we want to apply a bit of styling in there as well. So we'll make that out, use our hero image. Next, we want to have the title. So we'll throw a label in here. We'll set its text equal to coming from our binding. So we'll say bind this to our title here. And maybe we'll go and throw a style in here as well, like news title. And again, remember that styling is the same styling that you would use inside a WPF application. So, you know, it's just basically the styles that you're hopefully familiar with. All right, let's come back into our page, because we probably want the body of this as well. So I'll just go and copy this line of text here. And we'll change that from being our title to our body. All right, but we probably want to change that a little bit. So let's change that to news body. Cool. So now we've pretty much got the application looking how we want it to look. Next, what I might want to do is maybe the back-end guys have finished developing that service. So I can come into my code here, and maybe what I could do is I could just change that from being using my design data to actually go and use the real app client in that case. Okay, and then I can go ahead and I can build that application up. And basically what we've done here is we've created ourselves a cross-platform application. So here's our news application running. Inside of here, you know, we can navigate into our pages here. And because we are developing for Xamarin and we're using Xamarin Forms here, we've built a cross-platform application as well. So actually, we've also generated an iOS and a Windows Phone and a UWP version of this application as well. All right, fantastic. So one last thing, you know, if you're a Visual Studio developer and you're developing for iOS, then you might not want to be swapping across to your Mac all the time in order to go and have a look at this simulator. So here's something cool that we have now available as well. And this is the iOS simulator within Visual Studio. Okay, so just to be clear, what this is actually doing is it's still doing the build of your iOS application over on your Mac, and it's still actually running the simulator over on your Mac, but it's actually remoting that back over to your Windows machine. And that means that you never have to leave Visual Studio or your Windows environment. So you can get your Mac and you can tuck it away in a corner somewhere if you like. And as well as that, you actually get an added bonus as well. If you're working on a machine that has touch or it has a pen, then we get support for that in here as well, which is something you can't do over in your Mac. All right. So there we have it. We've created ourselves a nice little Xamarin application. We've consumed that Swagger file. And with that, I might hand you back to Jordan.
Thank you very much, Kim. And so We've seen how we can take our existing skills and produce cross-platform applications that target iOS, Android, and of course, Windows. Swagger made an appearance again. That Swagger thing we've been talking about all through it, it's one of the most important things around at the moment, especially as we have these interoperating systems. It allows you to generate SDKs for all sorts of platforms just because your system produces Swagger, and it's so easy to add. It's very hard for you to say, I shouldn't do this. Of course, we also saw Xamarin. Now, Xamarin is a 100% native cross-platform app development experience. It is not wrapped HTML or anything like that. It also has 100% API coverage that you'd expect from the native versions of those tools. What Kim didn't mention was the final piece of the puzzle, and that's Hockey App. And that's a way to actually build and deliver your apps to beta testers, as well as feedback information from the field about application insights and all that sort of thing. So that's Hockey App. So just to really paint the picture, we came from App Service with Nick, then we went through Swagger to generate an SDK, and then we ended up at Xamarin, and then all of a sudden our app runs on those platforms, the Windows, the iOS, and the Android. Using one UI design and one code base, we're able to design these fantastic cross-platform apps. I'd also like to call out that Kim is one of our fantastic Xamarin University lecturers. Xamarin University is instructor-led learning. It's in your local time zone. You can go ahead and learn about Xamarin and how to get up to speed as a Xamarin developer. Check out Xamarin University. So, we've got the center of our universe, the Azure App Service. We've got our software running on the machines and the computers that our users want them on. But that's just the first step of this personal computing movement, more personal computing. The trend is to make software, at the moment, is to make software more user-friendly or more people-friendly. There's a rush towards this human-centered tech that we can't get away from. People are starting to expect that. But first, before we can become human-centered, or we can create human-centered technology, we need our technology to be able to better understand the world. And that's where cognitive services comes in. Now, the beauty of cognitive services, and we'll get more into what it actually does in a minute, is that it's not hard to do. Now, even the most basic or introductory level software developer has access to advanced AI using cognitive services. It's a suite of services that are exposed by nothing more complex than a RESTful API. I like to think of it as an R&D department that's exposed via REST, your very own personal R&D department. It can see, it can read, it can speak, it can listen, plus a whole lot more. I like to think of cognitive services as a system that converts the world into JSON. And so I'm actually going to demo this one. Okay. Start off with a demo. A long, long time ago, in a data center just down the road, a man used cognitive services for no particular reason to make this demo other than he could. Demo over. So, it's actually set to US English, so my Aussie accent doesn't come off so great on that one. But that can work on any machine. Sure, Windows 10 has voice recognition in it, but in this case, it's just a RESTful call. It'll work on any platform. Let's try this one.
Okay, let me see. I'm sorry, I could not identify the image. Ha ha, just kidding. It's a man is smiling at the camera.
Maybe this AI thing isn't such a great idea after all. So that's using Computer Vision API. Again, available as a RESTful endpoint. Now, I'm going to jump onto the Cognitive Services website here, which is a website that contains the API documentation, but it also contains a way to actually test it out and see what you get. So, in this case, I've got a man swimming, and over on the right here, you can see that the text has been returned that it's a man swimming in a swimming pool. What I'm going to do is I'm going to open up another image. Now this one, I took out the window of a jet flying over the Pacific Ocean. It's at dusk. You can see part of a jet, but it's obviously not the typical image of a jet. And in this case, cognitive services will go away and process that, and it'll come back and will actually tell me that it is a plane flying over some clouds. That's a pretty obtuse example of it recognizing the real world. I click here, and I've got access to the API reference, much like what Nick showed earlier with the API portal. It's fully documented out here, but I can also go in and I can open the API testing console. And I can change a couple of parameters here, paste in a key. And down here, I can actually build the request. So in this case, I'm going to go and pick an image here, just a random one that I have lying around. And I'm going to set the body of this request. There we go. You can see down here, it's actually building the request for me. You can see that it's just a post up to the endpoint. I'll cruise down a bit now that the response has come back. And I can see that it's actually detected it as being Sachin Adela wearing glasses looking at the camera. It's telling me information about the real world, and I think that's absolutely awesome. Okay, jump out of that. All right, so seeing and speech recognition and everything is quite good, but I think one of the most important areas of cognitive service is perhaps the least obvious, and that's language understanding. Language understanding is really not that simple. It's easy to parse text, but it's really, really difficult to actually go and fully understand it. What I've done here is I've actually created a Postman request off to the server, and what it does, it's gone off to the Lewis endpoint and it said, book me a meeting for tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Now, that's come back in two parts. First, it's detected the intent, and that is to create a calendar entry. And you can see that in this particular variable here. So if I parse this JSON, it's become immediately obvious to me as a software developer what I'm trying to do here. The second part is the entities, because I said I wanted it to be tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. So it's given me two entities back. The resolution type here is it's a date time. The type is date time. And it's actually taken tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. and converted into an actual real value. So that's the 16th. It must be in American time. It's also given me a second value that shows me that it is at the time. It's at 9 o'clock. So I don't even have to go and do further parsing. And this is language understanding intelligent service. It's another system that's available up here on an endpoint. I'm able to go along and create my own Lewis JSON files, Lewis applications for my own app with words that I want to use. So in this case, I've got the Build News Lewis portal going here. We're building a news app. We've got the app service. We've got Xamarin, and now we're looking at how to actually understand what people are asking, ready for our next stage. So in Lewis, I go in and I enter a bunch of utterances that are examples of how I actually want to detect that news. I might be like, show me some news, show me some news about Xbox, and then I set them up as being intents and entities. And the end result is I go back into Postman here, and I can see I'm just going to do a request off to a RESTful endpoint, and I've said, show me some news about Microsoft Surface. I've obviously prepared this one earlier. And it's saying, get latest news, and it's saying, I would like news on Microsoft and Surface, please. And so that is the language understanding intelligent service. Now, all of these APIs are available on this one endpoint for you guys, on this one website. I strongly suggest you go along to the website and check it out. You can sign up for keys for free and get started. So that's the quick introduction to cognitive services. We're now able to do things that we couldn't possibly have even thought about doing even just 5 years ago without that R&D department at your disposal. And now it's available as a RESTful endpoint. It really is that easy. I was just in Postman doing that. And that's Microsoft's mission at work right there, to empower every person and every organization on the planet to achieve more. That democratization of AI and other services that Satya was talking about earlier, that is it there. That is it as a restful endpoint. It's through that democratization of advanced technologies that now everyone has access to the same bits and pieces. So that AI that you just saw, a high school student has the same access to that as a large corporate entity. So imagine what they can create. And I really want you to think about what you can create. I want to posit a question. Where is everyone? Now, it's not the question that was asked by Fermi a few years ago. It's a famous question about where is everyone in the universe. I want to ask you guys, whereabouts are your users? They're actually spending most of their time in over-the-top messaging clients. So you can see the results here. We've got Messenger, we've got Skype, and all sorts of other messaging apps, with messaging being right up there for mobile minutes. It's absolutely the place that your users are. And you guys need a way to get your code to run in those places. So the next step is the next UI, and that is language. We're going back to the original UI. We take an understanding of the real world that we just got from cognitive services, and we apply it in a way called conversations as a platform. And to introduce you guys to that and show you how simple it is using existing skills, I'd like to invite David Barella to the stage.
Thanks, Jordan. Now, Jordan just showed off the Azure Cognitive Services and demonstrated how to build a Lewis natural language understanding model. Now, what I want to do is take Jordan's Lewis understanding model and embed it within a chatbot so the users can go and look up news as I'd like. But before that, I'd like to show... Slides? Thanks. Before that, I'd like to show off some of the chatbots that we can start interacting with today. If you jump up to the Microsoft Bot Framework website, we have a bot directory. And we've got all these chatbots you can start using right now. We've got ones which are fun chatbots, utility chatbots. And so two I want to call out. The first one is AzureBot. Now, what AzureBot allows you to do is to, with some chat commands, log into your Azure account, list your virtual machines, start and stop your virtual machines. So very useful for when you've left the office and forgotten to stop that 16-core virtual machine. The second one I want to call out is Skyscanner. What Skyscanner is a chatbot that allows you to search for flights and will bring back the best deals for you. So if I click start over. Now, I've had a big week here preparing for this presentation. So this weekend, I just want to chill out. So let's go and go Sydney to Gold Coast this weekend. And just by using natural language, it can understand what I want to do, and it'll go off and start doing that search for me. Now, the very first thing I want to call out, though, is although this is a chatbot, we're not limited to just pure text. We can see here that what they've brought back is this beautiful hero card. We've got a splash image of the destination that we can go to, as well as some information about what they think we want to do. So from Sydney off to the Gold Coast, and it's put in the date for me for this weekend. Now, the second thing I want to call out is, although it is a chatbot, users don't just have to type in everything. If they're using a chatbot for the first time, they may not know the type of things that they can type in. So instead, we can go and surface these user interface elements to them so we can prompt them for the type of things that they can do to help around with that discoverability. So we've got a button there for more route tips. So if we click on that, it will go off and put down the text for us here so the user knows what they can type in next time. And then it'll go back and bring back a hero carousel of additional tips. But let's get back to that booking the flights. So it's asking me, when are we coming back? So again, UI prompt, I could say it's just one way, or I can keep going. So 3 days after arrival. And again, natural language, it's going to understand what I want to do, returning on Monday, and it's going to go off and search for those flights. And eventually, we'll come back with the results for me. So how do we go about building one of these things for ourselves? Well, again, Jordan just showed the Lewis model to go and do the natural language component of it. And so I'm going to take that, and we're going to use something called the Microsoft Bot Framework SDK. The Bot Framework SDK allows us to, within code, define how to take input in from the user, decide what we want to do for it, and format responses back for the user. So let's jump, here we go. And it's come back and it's brought up hero cards again with images showing off the flight details for you. So let's jump into Visual Studio. Now if we go file new project, we can see I've got a new application type here called bot application. And you can get that by jumping up to the bot framework website and installing the template. And if you do that, what you'll get is a stock standard web API project. Nothing too special about it. It's all standard web API, just like Nick was showing earlier today. What they do is add in some references to the bot framework assemblies to give you the functions to interact with it. And they create this one web API endpoint for you by default. And what they do, they give us one method. And this one method is what the bot connector will go and send all the messages from the user into here. And so very, very simple code. All we've got here is just one if statement. And it's this if statement, I've gone and hard-coded some commands here. So as the user types in help, we can go and prompt them. We just go construct a reply where we say, hey, the commands are show me the news, etc. If it wasn't the one that I've hard-coded, then we'll go and pass it all off to Jordan's Lewis. But we'll look at that in a second. Now, again, stock standard web API, so I can just hit start, and it'll go, and I can start debugging it locally. Now, I've got installed something called the Bot Framework Channel Emulator, which allows me to simulate a user interacting with this bot. So if I were to go and type in help and send that off, it'll go and hit my breakpoint where I can go and inspect things. Again, it's all standard code. So I hit continue, have a look, and it's come back with the response that I expected. Okay, great. Now, that's okay if I just want to hard code everything, but again, we want that natural language understanding. So we do it with this one line. I say, just pass whatever the user typed in, pass it off to Lewis. So I have to define this one class here. So this is the only code that I wrote in this thing. All the magic happens in these four lines. We've got my class, which I subclass the Lewis dialog. So as soon as I do that and call into this, all that magic happens of it being passed up to Lewis, because here I've got one attribute where I've defined Jordan's application ID for that Lewis model. So it will go off, the Lewis model will execute, figure out which user's intent that it was, and then because I've gone and just decorated it with these attributes, it automatically trigger the correct intent. So if we weren't able to figure out what they want to do, we'll just say, sorry, I don't understand. If we do match it, then it'll automatically invoke this method for get latest news. Now that Lewis bit's happened, we just drop back to normal code. So I've got a method here to get and create the cards. So all I do is that exact same web API that we've been talking about all day, I just go query it, bring back the news results, and construct up that response. I do a for each over, create a hero card for each news item, put in the news, put in some buttons for if I'd like to know more, and go from there. So if I type in show me the news, it'll go off, hit, get the correct intent, and brings it back. Now, because we're here, we're just using a generic user interface. So if we want to see that look beautiful, let's go and actually use this like a user would. And we can do that by exposing it via something called the bot connector. If we jump onto the bot framework website, we can go and register a new bot here. So I've deployed my web API up to Azure websites. So once I register my new bot, I simply give it where the endpoint is. I tell it which channels I want this to be available over. So I've exposed it over Skype and Microsoft Teams. So if I add it to Teams, I can see it in here, so I can start interacting with it. Type in help, type in show me the news, and it will much better inside of Microsoft Teams, format it much more nicely with those hero cards. Now, as Satya mentioned this morning, we just today released the Azure Bot Service under preview just a couple hours ago. So if you'd like to know more about the bot service, please jump up to the Azure website. And if you'd like, if listening to Webjet talk about the blockchain, got you excited about that as well, you can come to Microsoft Ignite and hear me speak about the blockchain there as well. Now with that, I'd like to hand it back to Jordan. Thanks.
Thank you very much, David. Okay, so we've now seen the way that we can take cognitive services and deliver it to another place that we didn't have access to before. Your code is now transiting through intelligence, and it's popping out in areas that I think are just absolutely fantastic and new and exciting, and I cannot wait to see how people do it. Just to really reinforce what's going on here, we've gone again from Azure App Service through Swagger to get the data out for the news, but this time, instead of landing in Xamarin, we've landed on the bot framework. And it itself is hosted on Azure App Service. It's then going out to different places this time. Instead of mobile apps, it's going out to Skype and Facebook Messenger and all sorts of other places. And so our journey from the center, the app service, a place for your code, through Xamarin delivering to your users where they are, and then providing a touch of intelligence via RESTful APIs that anyone can use, and ending up at this human-level interaction on a level that we've never seen before via the bot framework. Think about hairdressing bookings and booking your car for a service or getting some food delivered, and you won't have to actually talk to people. That's great for software developers, right? So interacting with the real world in conversational terms that we've never seen before. We're lucky enough today to actually have a couple of developers standing backstage who've gone through a lot of this process for Realsies using Xamarin to build a cross-platform app that is powered by Azure. So I want to first throw to a video and then invite Rossano and Wayne out on stage from the 9 News app.
A storm is about to hit your house. We'll alert you. A major crash on the road in front of you. We'll alert you. A crime happens in your suburb. We'll alert you. Just download the 9 News Alerts app and click on News Near Me, the only news app that alerts you when news happens close to your location. Available for free in the Apple App Store and Google Play. Now.
Look, guys, thank you very much for coming down here today. As I mentioned, Wayne and Rossano have actually built a cross-platform Xamarin app that is now available out in the wild via the App Store of your choice. So, guys, thank you very much again. And how about you tell us a little bit about your app?
Okay. Our app is slightly different to your typical news app in that we can send you notifications as news breaks straight to your device or even your watch, which really gives us a large amount of engagement with our audience. Further to that, we have a feature called News Near Me. It can send you location-based alerts, so it can tell you about things that are going on nearby to you. We also allow you to choose topics that you're interested in. Cool. For example, weather, sport, traffic. We can tell you while you're driving down a main road that there's an accident up ahead while
awesome.
You're on that road.
And so you're actually able to tell where people are and inform them of news in the area.
Absolutely.
Awesome. And how long did that take to build?
Okay. So it took about 4 to 5 months to deliver. We felt that we got a massive leg up by the partnership between Xamarin and Azure in the familiarity of the tools and the languages.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And so how many downloads has the app actually had? I hear it's doing well around the world.
Yeah, in the past 12 months, I think we had over 250,000 downloads. We have users all over the world. Big concentration in UK, US, Southeast Asia, and other 70 countries, if I'm not wrong.
Wow. So there's obviously a bit of scale going on. It's 250,000 downloads. How would you power something like that? What does the back end look like? What's the setup doing back there?
Okay, so the back end is powered by Azure Mobile App Services. This allowed us to build out our API quite quickly and easily. And integrate it quite easily into the Xamarin app. It also allowed us to scale really well with the auto-scaling features of the app services. We were also able to easily integrate in the Azure Notification Hubs, which gave us a really nice abstraction over the idiosyncrasies of the different platforms' notification methods.
Great. I was actually going to ask about that. Like, if you're doing live push out to a whole range of devices, how are you doing that? So through notification hubs, how many would you say that you push at a time? How many devices are you pushing to each time?
Depends on each story, as we mentioned. Like, it's highly targeted, depending on your settings. But for example, for the Trump election, we were sending over 200,000 notifications in every update that was happening.
Absolutely awesome, guys. So I'd like to give a big call out to go and download the 9 News Alerts app. Go and give it a shot and get localized news for you guys. It's a cross-platform Xamarin app. Thank you very much, right. Rosano and Wayne.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you. Thank you. And so, guys, everything we've talked about today, people are out there actually doing it. They are building cross-platform apps. They are building intelligence into their apps using all sorts of wonderful new APIs and things that just simply wouldn't have been possible even just a few years ago. The code section is just about to wrap up. Before I do, I just want to leave you with a reminder to go and check out the repo. You can go and try everything that we've talked about today. But I'm just about to go now before I hand over to Anthony, who's going to do the DevOps section of today. I want to show you a video as I walk off that really demonstrates how cognitive surfaces and the fact that they're so simple to use can be used in a real-world app that's actually out there today. So thank you very much, and here's the video.
We come to work every day to pilot, test, and launch new technology solutions. Real-time ID check is the latest technology example where we at Uber are constantly developing and testing new solutions to predict, prevent, and reduce security risks in ways that weren't possible before. It's through this partnership with Microsoft that we've been able to develop this technology quickly and ensure that every rider and every driver has an excellent experience. Real-time ID check is a prompt that appears in the driver's app, asking them to take a self photo. We can do a check in real time to make sure that that identity of the person who took the picture matches the account holder who's been approved to drive. Doing that serves a couple of purposes. Drivers know that their identities and their accounts are being protected, and riders know that the driver who they're with has been screened.
Jen?
Evan?
Yeah.
Real-time ID is a smart technology. What that means is it factors in and addresses the edge cases. The situation where the driver is wearing glasses or a hat and they weren't in the identification that we have on file. The beautiful thing is it can recognize these changes and ask the driver to remove their sunglasses or retake the photo. The partnership with Microsoft Cognitive Services allowed us to go from idea to execution to implementation across the country in a matter of months. Already, we've been able to make thousands of rides safer, and very soon we're going to be making millions of rides safer through this technology.
Please, another round of applause for Jordan and Nick and Kim and the 9 news team. So I know that we've done some dev, and I can even see beyond the spotlights that the devs, when we say DevOps, they go, oh God, not DevOps. I don't want you to feel that way. They put dev in DevOps for a reason, because really it's about how do you deploy and manage these massive scale applications that go out to the hundreds of thousands and millions of your users. And so to give you a crash course in DevOps, I want to bring out our DevOps guru, Anthony Borton.
Thank you, mate. Thank you, Lawrence. Thank you for that wonderful introduction and the opportunity to be part of this great event. And hopefully my voice will make it through the 20 minutes. All right, so again, my name's Anthony Borton. I'm a Visual Studio ALM MVP, and a DevOps trainer and consultant. I deliver DevOps training and consulting to organizations around the world, and I travel a lot. This year alone, so far, I've traveled, I think, 215,000 kilometers through 38 cities and 8 countries. TripIt's great for that stuff. So lots of travel, I guess, is a summary of me at the moment. Whenever we talk about DevOps, we want to talk about the 3 key pillars. The first of those pillars is people. We want to collaborate more. We want to share common goals and bring people together. We want to talk about process, eliminate waste, increase efficiency, and deliver value to our customers, our stakeholders, faster. And finally, the tooling. We want to enhance productivity, enable collaboration, and execute a successful DevOps strategy. If we have a look at the shift to DevOps, traditional teams have focused on planning. Plan, plan, plan for success. And that hasn't worked well for us. We've encouraged our teams often to compete, our individuals to compete for success. And we're focused on individual productivity. These haven't really given us the results that we wanted. High-performing teams today in a DevOps world focus on delivering. That's the value, delivering, you know, value to our customers, our stakeholders, you know, having really great raving fans. We want to look at the effectiveness of our outcomes and measure that. There's some great statistics available in the 2016 State of DevOps report from the Puppet and Dora guys. I'll call out just a couple of those. So high-performing teams that have successfully adopted DevOps do 200 times more deployments. And they have lead times over 2,500 times shorter than traditional teams, so that we can get, you know, that value, get those changes and enhancements to our users so much faster. And maybe one more. I love this one. They spend 22% less time on unplanned work and rework. Just imagine getting 22% of our day back to be more productive and do different things. So, you know, DevOps has some great benefits there that we can realize. I want to talk to you about some of the capabilities of Visual Studio Team Services and Team Foundation Server, some capabilities that you can go back to the office today and start utilizing to try and drive better success and DevOps outcomes. First pillar that we're going to talk about is agile planning. We want to talk about how we can work with our flexible and our fluid teams to plan. We want to look at the Kanban boards and see how we can go in there and customize that Kanban board, how we get live updates, and we can see and track exactly where our progress is. We want traceability. We want to be able to look at a line of code and say that, well, that line of code was modified or written for, you know, this task, which is part of this user story, which is part of this feature. And conversely, go the other way, full bi-directional traceability there. You may have also heard in the last couple of weeks Microsoft release Microsoft Teams, a great way of aiding collaboration. Thursday in the US, Wednesday in the US, Thursday here, they increased support for collaboration between Teams and Visual Studio Team Services. What you're looking at here is a screenshot showing Microsoft Teams, and I can see the Kanban board directly in Teams. Now, that's just not a, I mean, it's a screenshot here, but it's not a screenshot, of course, when you look at Teams. We can collaborate, we can talk about the backlog. In addition to that, I can raise events into the conversation thread. I can say that I'm particularly interested in build events, and in the conversation thread, build events can bubble up for us. I can say that I'm interested in work item tracking. When a new bug gets created, include that in the thread so we don't risk missing it. So that's enough talking. How about we have a look at some of the capabilities and features? So I'll switch over to my machine, and my machine's strategically hidden at the back here. So I'm just going to do a little reorganization. Okay. This is one of those super-powered keyboards. I've got an entire computer as part of my keyboard now. And we need a mouse. And I can sit down the clicker and power that on. All righty. And we're there. So what you see here is our product backlog. Anyone that's been using TFS or VSTS will be familiar with this. We can easily go and add things to the backlog. We can drag and drop, reprioritize it. And that's a great experience for us. I'm going to move across and focus a little bit more on the Kanban board. and my machine was having a nice little rest there while you were being entertained. All right. So looking at the Kanban board here, the Kanban board can be easily customized. I've gone and added a split column up there. So in active, I've got doing and done. I can use styling. Pop up here and say, in terms of the cards, here are some styling rules. Simply change the visual display of those cards to indicate certain state or information, to draw our eyes there as we need to. If there's something that's a priority one bug, for example, change the color of the card to red. I've also said that anything with a demo 3 tag, I'd like to also change the color of that one. So, you know, customizing and changing those is a trivial thing to do. Going and highlighting different tag colors. And this is something a little bit more recent, the ability for us to be able to see on that board to track from the requirement into the tasks and see where the developers are up to with that, to be able to see the tests that relate to that particular requirement and the current state of them. Let's have a look at that for a moment. So you'll see here on my Kanban board that I'll have a look at this particular requirement here that Jordan's working on. I can see that there are two tasks, and both of those tasks have been completed. I can easily add tasks if I need to. I can review the test results and see that there are 4 tests written to test this particular requirement. And of those 4 tests, 3 of them are passing right now, and 1 of them's never been run. Now, I can put a lot more information on there. We've got a limited screen real estate, but you know, this is a great, great reason for you to convince your boss. We all need Surface Hubs. Wouldn't that be awesome? Just say Anthony said, I don't know, that's going to give you a lot of leverage, but a nice big screen certainly would make a lot of difference. I can also go up here and just turn on live updates. So a simple click of the button, and I can display this on a monitor in the team room, and that's going to live refresh for me. So at any point in time, I can just simply see how our team's progressing. So visualizing work is one of the key things we can deliver here. All right, back over to some demos. Back over to the slides. Something else that I want to talk about is test and feedback. With test and feedback, firstly, feedback. So getting good, timely feedback from our stakeholders can be the difference between project success and failure, between happy stakeholders and customers and maybe less than happy stakeholders and customers. But we want to be able to capture that feedback in a reliable, traceable way. We don't want to encourage feedback by the water cooler or feedback in the car park or text messages. Wouldn't it be nice if we could easily capture feedback directly in the tool? I want to talk about the Microsoft Test and Feedback extension. This became generally available only in the last couple of weeks. And it's a great little extension currently available for us in Chrome, but of course Firefox and Edge support are coming very soon. Does anyone know there's a little virtual conference starting tomorrow? So having this the day before is really unfortunate, but you can't worry about that too much. So in terms of democratizing feedback and testing, we want to allow anyone on our team to submit bugs, to provide feedback, and contribute to the overall quality of the application. This isn't taking anything away from our professional testers, not for a moment. But in a DevOps environment, everyone on the team fulfills a role of testing. We're always looking at the product. We're always envisaging the changes, making sure they're okay, and helping out maybe our dedicated testers by providing some of this feedback. Installing this extension, this free extension, is easy. We can go over to marketplace.visualstudio.com, which I'll talk about again a little later. I can go in there and select Visual Studio Team Services, type in test and feedback, and you'll see the little icon there, and I can click on install to quickly install that into my browser. Once it's in the browser, you'll get that little icon that you can see up next to the address bar, and I can configure this extension to talk to Visual Studio Team Services in the cloud, or I can configure it to talk to my on-premises TFS server, or even make it completely standalone. So that's nice and quick and easy to use. Let's have a look at that in action. So I'm going to just jump up here. There's my extensions, and I can go and choose test and feedback. and I can install it, but in the interest of time, I've already done that. What I'd like to do here is to switch over to, actually, let's do it a different way. Don't you like those demos that you just make up on the fly almost? So having a look at that requirement that we looked at a moment ago, I want to go and explore that. I want to have a look at it. And I want to do that not as a, necessarily as a tester, but any team member. So I'll select this requirement and say that I want to do exploratory testing. What that's doing now is that's going to tell me that we can go and start exploring. And if you see up here next to the address bar, that icon's flashing to draw our attention. I'll switch over to the DX News application. And in this example, what I want to do is simply do some testing of that API. Up here, you can see that I'm connected to VSTS. And let's start my exploratory testing session. You'll see that it's showing me information about the work item that I'm exploring. You'll see that I can see acceptance criteria. And of all my acceptance criteria, we've got to include created date. I'll go ahead and say, well, I want to start recording what I do. Because if we find a bug, a problem, and so on, wouldn't it be nice if we could provide our developers with accurate repo steps? I'll click Start Recording. And let's go ahead and click the little button there. So we'll drill into this particular thing, and lo and behold, there's no created date there. Now, I want to go and create a bug for this. So back up to my little extension. Let's go and create a screenshot. I want to provide this information to my developers. my apologies. And I want to be able to decorate that particular screenshot. I'll point down here, add some text, and say created date is missing. There might be some personally identifiable information on there that I can easily go and blur out. And then I'll say OK. So that's captured that screen capture quickly and easily. I'm going to include just some observations. I'm going to say the page is loading slowly. And I'll leave my typo there. They'll know it's from me. Right now, I can choose to go in there and say, I want to create a bug, or maybe it's a task. Maybe I want to create a test case, but of course, for me, it's a bug. And as I start typing here, the created date is missing. Now, you'll see there, it's found one similar bug. And the purpose of this is to try and reduce duplicates by saying, well, maybe someone has already reported this bug. And I can click on that, I can review that work item, and maybe I don't need to go and create this. In my example, I'll say, save it. And I'll finish my exploratory testing now. But there's nothing stopping me from spending the next 20 minutes, except for I'd get booted off stage, doing more exploratory testing. I'll switch back over to my user stories. Let's have a look at the homepage. And what we should see here is that bug. I now have one open bug. I'll select that bug, and let's see what information was shared with me from that test and feedback extension. Okay, we'll open the bug. I'll go and assign it to the root cause of most bugs. That's Jordan, unfortunately. And if we have a look down here, what you'll see is some screenshots of what I was doing, how I was interacting with the application. There's the marked up screenshot that I decorated and included. The observation, the screen recording, and some system information's included. But I want to come back up here. One of the things that I did when I raised the bug, I left two checkboxes checked. One of them said include page load data. So I can select here, click on that. And that's going to include information about the duration of each of the different artifacts in that page. So one of my observations was the page is loading slowly. The information that's shared here, and of course we have to scroll over to see anything really interesting, the information that's shared here should hopefully allow Jordan to get a fix in for that page nice and quickly. All right, so I'll exit out of there. There's our bug in action. So back over to the slides now. Another challenge we have is that we're no longer, keep going voice, is we're no longer working with applications that are just a few thousand lines of code. Many of the applications we're working on have hundreds of thousands or millions of lines of code. And as a developer, you can't be expected to be intimately familiar with all of that code. It's just not possible for most humans anyway. So I want to talk about code search and some enhancements and capabilities we have with code search. Code search is available in Visual Studio Team Services and also in the next version of Team Foundation Server, currently called TFS 15, and maybe until tomorrow. We can quickly and efficiently find relevant information in our C# code, C, C++, Java, or Visual Basic code. So let's have a look at it. So before I do that, developers lose a lot of productivity going in and finding things, scrolling through code that they're not familiar with often. I want to give you a scenario. I've gone and grabbed the .NET Core Framework, something I promise I haven't contributed to. So I do not know this code. There's a dialogue, there's a pop-up there that includes the word serialize, and I want to go and change it. How many places do you think the word serialize will appear in the .NET Core Framework? I'd say quite a few. Let's switch back to demos. Okay, so I'm over here in code search. Here's my application. I'm going to simply go up to the top here, and I'm going to start searching. Now, search isn't new. We've had Control-F find over files for a long time, haven't we? So if I say serialize, that's going to go and have a look through my code, not just in this project, but other projects and potentially across team project collections, not quite yet. And what we've found here is we've got over 160 instances of the word serialize across two projects. Now, I can go looking through those 160 instances. That's not a whole lot of fun. Look at what it's done on the left-hand side. It's gone and had a look at the key differentiators for each of those 160 instances, and it's narrowed that down. We can see here that it's used as an argument, in a comment, in a definition. Well, my usage was string literal, so I can simply click here and narrow the 160 down to just 6 occurrences where that text is used as a string literal. I could have done that, you know, in advance by popping up to the code search window and typing string lit serialize. Let's see how my typing went. And by simply decorating the search with that, that prefix, it's narrowed it down for me automatically. You may have seen that there's a lot of other choices here. So if I'm looking for a particular string in a constructor, I can narrow it down and say, well, look, I just want to find it in a constructor. Okay, I want to see it in a declaration or in a property. So code search can greatly benefit the developers. All right, back to the slides. I also want to talk about package management. Package management is a great way for us to share packages within our organization, across our teams, encouraging reuse. Many of you are probably, you know, using package managers right now. We're probably familiar with NuGet, NPM, and there's a bunch of other ones out there. Microsoft Package Management is also coming to TFS and VSTS. And what's compelling about this one is, A, it's going to support a lot of different package formats over time, but it's tightly integrated in our CI/CD pipelines, allowing us to publish those packages quickly and conveniently with full control and approval processes, and then we can go and consume them quickly and easily as well. Back to the demos. So I'll just switch out to a different project. And I can show you a demonstration of NuGet, but that's not as interesting, I'm sure. Let's instead choose NPM, okay? So in this team project, I'm going to go up and I'm going to choose packages. Okay, that's an extension that I've added. And you can see here I have a number of NuGet feeds. I can secure these using the same security that I'm using for my team projects today. There's no additional overhead on me. I can do things like unlist. I can delete packages. I can use, you know, organizational processes that are not necessarily available to me in public repositories and package managers. I'm going to say that I want to create a new feed. This feed is going to be called my NPM feed. I can say that you know, anyone in my account can view those. I can say that the team members can add packages. I'm going to allow the build service to add packages so that they can exist in my CI/CD pipeline. And then down the bottom here, this is really quite compelling. This is enabling pass-through. So when my team want to go and consume NPN packages, I can say, well, look, come to the Microsoft Package Management Service, and if the package they're looking for does not exist there, do I pass that through to the public registry or not? Okay. And that gives me control over whether I want to limit those packages only to ones created in my organization or not. Okay, let's go ahead and create that feed. And I can go in to connect to that feed. Instead of NuGet, I'll switch over to NPM, grab the text that you see here, pop over to code into my NPMRC file, paste that there and save it. And then I could easily go and use NPM init and NPM publish to publish those packages up to the package management service. So well worth having a look at that. All right, back to the slides. In terms of empowering our teams, part of that is allowing teams to use the tools and technologies they want to use. And that's not just Microsoft technologies. I'd like to think that many of you use Microsoft technologies in your development teams, but I'm fairly confident that you probably don't use those exclusively. There are some great tools out there. So we want to leverage that. We want to make it easy for you to use some of those compelling tools. So while the Visual Studio Marketplace isn't new, it's been out for probably close to 12 months now, I just want to mention that to you again, where we can go and browse for third-party extensions from both Microsoft and third parties. We can discover those, we can install them with a single click. It's the glue that can allow us to tie these things together. I could pop in there, but I'm running short on time there. I could go and say, I use Octopus Deploy. So I can type in Octopus here, find that extension, add that into my VSTS account quickly and easily, and just like that, I'm using a third-party tool. You saw in Kim's demonstration earlier today that he was creating applications for a variety of different platforms. So if I was to go into the marketplace and say Apple Store, you'll find an extension there that I can put into my CI/CD pipeline to quickly and easily publish to the Apple Store or the Microsoft Store or Google Play. So it makes it nice and quick and easy for us. There's also Monitor and Learn, which is application insights. Any good DevOps talk should include monitoring, learning, closing the loop. But I think I'd rather say keep an eye out tomorrow for announcements from Connect. There's some interesting things happening in that space. So to recap, we've talked about agile planning, some great test and extension capabilities, how developers can search for code much more quickly and easily. I've talked about package management and given you a teaser about some upcoming changes to monitoring. What I'd like to do now is invite Ken Thompson up on stage to talk about integrating open source DevOps on Azure. Welcome, Ken.
Excellent. Thanks, Anthony. Morning, everyone, or afternoon now. So at Microsoft, we're passionate about open source technologies. We know it's important to you, our customers. We know it plays a pivotal role in your DevOps journey. Ultimately, this is about choice and flexibility. It's about giving you a cloud platform that provides you the freedom to use the tools and technologies that work best for you and your teams. When we look at how we're approaching open source, first, we're enabling open source technologies. So this is taking popular Linux distributions like Red Hat Enterprise Linux, SUSE or Ubuntu, through to container-optimized operating systems like CoreOS or Rancher, making these available in our marketplace or also the capability to bring your own. We're also integrating open source technology solutions. So these are offerings like Azure Container Service, where we provide a Docker orchestration engine of choice, or Azure Cache, where we provide managed Redis cache. And it's about making these best-of-breed open source technologies really easy to stand up and get going and derive business value from. We're also releasing key Microsoft products into the open source domain. So things like PowerShell, we made that available. You can now use that cross-platform on Mac, Linux, and Windows desktops to manage both Linux and Windows operating systems. We've also released .NET Core into the open source ecosystem. And we know it's important to contribute to projects outside of the Microsoft umbrella. So this is where we're doing a lot of contributions to the broader ecosystem because that's the right thing to do for the open source communities. And to put that into perspective, on GitHub alone, Microsoft engineers have contributed over 750 million lines of code. And to put that into even more perspective, Linux all up is 25 million lines of code. So the investment from us here is really significant. And when we talk about giving you choice and flexibility of tooling to help your teams really go fast, you also need some consistency on how you're going to manage that across platforms, whether you're deploying into the Azure public cloud, onto on-premise, or even other public clouds. This is where we have products like Microsoft Operations Management Suite to provide you that consistency across all those environments, regardless of whether your applications are running on Linux or Windows. And you can have consistency in how you're automating those environments, managing them, securing them, and providing business continuity. And it even plugs into all our third-party ISV ecosystem. So let's have a look at some of the technologies that we can put together in Azure, in open source. We've crammed a fair bit in, so if we just change to the demo. So to kick off, we're going to provision a Red Hat Enterprise Linux virtual machine from the marketplace here. And I'm going to choose version 7.3. That was released, I think, just last week, so already available in the Azure marketplace. We're going to put in some basic information here, give it a name, put in our username, put in our SSH key, as is best practice with Linux virtual machines. I'm going to use the existing resource group that I've already got set up in the Southeast Australia data center. All right, so in terms of virtual machine size, I'm just going to choose a recommendation, which is a DS2 V2. So same specs as the original D2s, but with faster hardware underneath, and the S denotes that we've got persistent disk. I'm going to leave all the settings as default, but what I do want to do is add an extension. So extensions allow us to perform automated tasks for you on your virtual machines, Windows or Linux. And we can choose from a bunch of different extensions here. We can install Docker, virus scan, backup. But the one I'm interested here is the Linux Chef extension. So I'm going to come here. I'm going to put in some basic information for my Chef server to hook this Red Hat Enterprise Linux VM up to that Chef server. I'm going to give it a run list, which is my Chef cookbook, to do all the configuration that I want. We're going to give it the key to my Chef server. And that's all we need to do. So we'll click OK. This will go and configure that extension for our virtual machine. We're then going to run a final validation check on the Azure Resource Manager JSON definition behind this provisioning. And we'll click OK. So that'll take a minute or so to boot the VM. And then Chef's going to go and bootstrap it, install all the packages I need for my demo. So let's go and have a look at one that I provisioned yesterday to give you an idea of what Chef is actually doing there. So Chef is an open source configuration management tooling. And we've created a cookbook here, which allows us to, we're installing a bunch of packages. So we're installing Git, we're installing Node.js, Docker. We're also pulling down the code from the repo. So another thing Chef does is it allows you to apply this configuration as compliant. So we actually we can see that our machines are checking here back every 30 minutes to make sure they're in the right configuration that we want. So let's jump into one of these machines now. So we'll log in to my RHEL dev box. You'll notice I'm using Bash on Ubuntu on Windows, so allows me to use the tool, open source tooling I'm familiar with. And first, well, let's jump into where our code is. And we'll just have a look at our Git config here. So we can see that we're pulling from the where aka.ms/the repo. That's going to point you over here. So we're pulling that code. And if we jump into the application code directory, we can see all our application code in here that we've pulled down. So first, what I'm going to do is I'm going to switch to the demo user that Chef has configured for me with the appropriate permissions. And we've got the same .NET Core application that guys had earlier. So the first thing we need to do for that is we need to do a .NET restore. And what that's going to do is going to go and look at our project JSON. It's going to look at all those NuGet dependencies, and it's going to pull them down into our project, anything that's required, and restore them into the directory. So I've done that, and then the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to build a Docker container out of that application. So I'm going to use YoDocker. So Yo is short for YoMan. That's a basically a scaffolding generator. You can get a number of different plugins for it. And the ones I've got installed already are the .NET Core plugin and also the Docker one. So I've choose defaults, and what that's going to do is it's going to go and look at our application, our project JSON, all our dependencies. It's going to create a Docker file here for us. So what we've got here is our basic Docker file. It's going to look at everything we need and create all that for us. So it's telling us to run this Docker sh command. So let's run that. It's giving us a number of options here. We've got a build, compose, and another number of other commands. And because our application is still in development, I know that we need to build from the .NET SDK. So let's run the build using the debug parameter. Now, this is basically going to take our .NET app. We're going to compile it if we're quick enough or too quick. We'll see the difference from the Docker file that where it wasn't the debug version, and this is using debug, is we're getting that SDK image from the Docker Hub. And then we're building the app, we're copying everything from our application directory into the Docker container, and now we've built a Docker container with that code. So let's have a look at that. So I've got this Docker image here. So what I want to do is I want to put that image in a registry somewhere. So I'm going to tag this. And I'll tag it as DXNews API. And you'll notice that I've also got a private Docker registry here, which is on Azure. So we announced last week the new service Azure Container Registry. And that provides you with a private Docker registry that's hosted on Azure, local to your applications. Backed by Azure Active Directory for role-based access control. And it's also Docker Registry version 2 compliant. So any of your existing tooling and pipelines that use Docker now will just plug in and work straight away with the Azure Container Registry. All right, so now we've pushed that somewhere. Now we want to go and deploy it somewhere. So something that we also announced last week was support for Kubernetes on Azure Container Service. Alongside Docker Swarm and Mesosphere DCOS are the other Docker orchestration options that we provide on Container Service. So if we have a look here, kubectl is the command line interface that you use to manage Kubernetes clusters. And we've already got a cluster set up in Azure. It takes less than 5 minutes to spin up. You can provision it from the portal or from command line really, really quick to get started. So let's run a kubectl proxy. And what that's going to do is going to create an SSH tunnel through my local host on port 8001. And we'll be able to go into our cluster here securely through the local host. So here we have my Kubernetes dashboard. It's a brand new cluster, so I don't have anything provisioned yet. So first thing we'd want to do is create an application. So really easy to come in here and just specify a Docker image from Docker Hub or another private registry, specify app name and click deploy. I've already got a JSON definition for my deployment, so let's go and select that. And we'll upload that. And we'll see straight away that it's started to deploy my application out. So we've got our DXNews API. You can see the shortening of my private registry and my image here. And it's also created a replica set here, which will allow me to scale my application out. And we should also see, we've also got a pod running straight away. So something else we announced jointly with the Kubernetes announcement last week was a Visual Studio Code extension for Kubernetes. So Visual Studio Code is our open source standard created developer environment in the Visual Studio family. And the Kubernetes extension allows us to manage Kubernetes clusters, whether they're on Azure Container Service or anywhere else. So you can see in here, I've got my integrated terminal. I'm using Bash and Ubuntu on Windows here as well. But what I want to show you is the Kubernetes extension. What we're going to do is a Kubernetes load. And I know that I just created a deployment. It was called DXNews API. So I'll load that up, and that's going to go off to the cluster, and it's going to pull down the configuration of that DXNews API here into my editor window. And then we can also run other commands like Kubernetes describe. And you'll notice that it didn't prompt me for the resource that I wanted to describe. It actually picked up the context from the editor window that I'm already looking at this, and it's pulled it into here. So what I want to do is I want to scale this up. So I'm going to change it from one replica to 20 replicas. So let's scale this application out. So I'll save our JSON. And now we're going to run a Kubernetes apply. And that was successful. So let's go over to the cluster and see if we can catch that. So we can see now it's already applied the change to the application I deployed. So it's already changed the declarative state of the application to 20. And if we go into replica sets again, we'll just give it a refresh. See, it's already scaled up to 17 out of 20. So really, really quick to scale out. So some of the other things we've got with Kubernetes on Azure Container Service is native support for Azure networking and Azure storage. So what it's going to done is create a service to externalize these containers. And it's using Azure Load Balancer to load balance across the containers. And it's using an Azure public IP address here for us to be able to access that. So now I can go to Azure DNS, where I've got a domain name on azure.io. And I can put in dxnewsapi.onazure.io. I can put in my A record for my IP address. And then we should be able to hit our application that we just built. And there we go. So if we go back to my last slide, so what we saw there is we provisioned a Red Hat Enterprise Linux virtual machine from the marketplace. We configured it with Chef. We used Bash and Ubuntu or Windows a number of times. We took the exact same .NET Core application the guys had earlier, built it on Linux, put it in a Docker container, launched it in Kubernetes on Azure Container Service, and scaled it out with Visual Studio Code. So we've looked at some Microsoft tooling and also some open source tooling, but what if your company are using other tooling, such as that from Atlassian? So with that, I'd like to welcome Paul Bauer to the stage, who's going to talk about what Microsoft and Atlassian have been doing together. Over to you, Paul.
So we've been working with Atlassian, looking at a number of scenarios, specifically around DevOps and what this can do. We're looking at streamlining DevOps scenarios. For those of you not familiar with Atlassian, they are a company that produces great software looks at tools for teams and collaboration. I'd like to share with you some of the highlights of the work we've been doing with Atlassian over the last few months. One of the most frequent requests we get from our customers is that they ask us, can they use their Office 365 credentials with their Atlassian products? Now, before a lot of you say to me, this is a DevOps scenario talk and we're talking about identity, just give me the benefit of the doubt. Identity forms a very core part of a number of scenarios. So what we did is we worked with Atlassian to look at integrating some of their SAML, to produce SAML integration with Azure AD for their data center products. What this gives you is the ability to log into your existing, use your existing Office 365 credentials to log into your Atlassian applications. This is such an important piece of work that Atlassian also announced this recently at their Atlassian Summit Conference in San Jose. So we've talked about identity. Let's move back into this, into the DevOps scenarios. To illustrate how these scenarios work, I'll use an example team, and we'll look at they'd like to deploy their application into Azure and monitor it. So let's look at Jane. She's a developer, and she has just committed her application code into Bitbucket. Now she wants to deploy that application code into Azure, into a web app. One of the existing ways we've seen before is in the web app tools, you can associate a Bitbucket repo with your web app. Now, whenever you push to Bitbucket, that application code will get deployed to your Azure web app. One of the other bits we've been working with Atlassian recently is around looking at a different way to do this with their Bitbucket pipeline technology. So this is the continuous delivery capability that is hooked onto Bitbucket. We've provided guidance around Azure and also some VS Code, Visual Studio Code tooling that makes this really easy. So now Jane has another option. She can set up the Bitbucket pipeline. And whenever she commits to Bitbucket, Bitbucket pipelines will push that code directly into Azure. Jane is exceptionally happy now because her application is running in Azure on a web app. But her boss comes to her and asks, how do we know if the application is still running and how do we know if Azure is having a problem? He wants to have Jira issues created automatically whenever there's an issue with Azure, or when there's an issue with the application. Jane thinks this sounds a little bit complicated, but we did a little bit of work with Atlassian to make this easy. We can take the alerts coming out of the new monitor service on Azure and couple those with an Azure add-on, with a Jira add-on for Azure that we've built, and that will automatically create Jira issues for you directly from your alerts. So the first step in setting this up is you create a whole bunch of alerts in Azure through Azure Monitor. And for each of those alerts, you configure the webhook to talk to the endpoints exposed by the Jira add-on. And then you get Jira issues created automatically for you in Jira from those alerts. We saw earlier in Satya's talk and in some of the talks that Microsoft Flow is a really easy way to connect various services. And we've also done some work with Atlassian around this. We've built a Jira connector, and here we can actually use the Jira connector and some of the templates we've released to easily connect Slack with Jira. There are a number of other components that you can connect. So in this case, John, who's a teammate of Jane, he'd like to get Slack notifications for his team whenever a Jira issue is created. So he uses this template and sets it up and connects Jira and Slack. Now, whenever a Jira issue is created, he'll automatically get a notification in the Slack team room. John is also big on dashboards. He'd like to have the whole team look at all the details in Jira and make it easily consumable. So this is where we worked with Atlassian around building out a Power BI content pack. This allows you to easily connect Jira and Power BI and build dashboards such as the one on the screen behind me. So we've looked at a number of scenarios where you can work your way with Atlassian and Microsoft. The key takeaway I'd like to leave you with is that Atlassian and Microsoft are working together to streamline a number of scenarios for our shared customers. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks again for coming out today and joining us for a day about developer productivity and DevOps. We really appreciate it. Don't forget, everything you saw today, we are streaming it on Channel 9 on MSDN, so we'll have that up later today. And right now, you can go to aka.ms/therepo, and it'll send you off to the GitHub repo in order to pull down the code, and you can build this out yourself. And also, don't forget your water bottle. So you have a discount code to come do technical sessions in February at Ignite. And with that, I'll say thank you for joining us, and have a safe trip.